Welcome back to a brand new episode of Brain Pops, episode 55. Brain Pops, the podcast approaching mental and physical challenges behind the scenes of professional sports. As always, with me, my dear friend, Lennart Stechmann. Lennart, how are you?
I'm very good, Dom. Nice to see you back in English. And I'm really looking forward to this episode, as always. Yeah, please introduce our guest, because you had this marvelous idea of inviting him. So, yeah.
Yeah, today we have Alex Sarama on the show. And Alex right now is based in Italy. And maybe I'll give just a few cliff notes about him. And if I do something wrong, he will probably correct me afterwards. Yeah, Alex shares team and player development ideas for coaches, teams, federations, and organizations all around the world. And these ideas are based on the CLA, the constraint-led approach, and ecological dynamics. And I think these two terms we will discuss in more detail during the show.
We should.
And right now, he's the head coach at College Prep in, now let's see if I can pronounce that the right way, Borgo Manero in Italy. And he also serves as a player improvement specialist for Paris Basketball. What that means, I think we'll also touch on once we have him on the show. And yeah, if you don't have anything to add to this, I would just say
Shortly. yeah, and maybe what I think what needs to be said is that he seems to be somebody, or to me when I listen to interviews and podcasts of him, that is, I would say, riding ahead of the wave a little bit. That's what it seems like in the basketball world. I think we have to add. And I think it's always really fun to talk to guys like that, to get like very new ideas that are maybe not spread as wide yet as other ideas that we had on this podcast. So that's what I'm really looking forward. And also your last addition that he's working with a pro team, because I can imagine there to spread the word there about his new methods might be a little bit harder than, for example, with youth players who are open to this. So, yeah, please, let's dive in and get him on the show.
Yes, I think we have a lot of topics to get through. Let's get him on the show. Alex, there you are. How are you? Good to have you on the show.
Dom, great to be here. Thanks for having me on. I think, you know, Lennart, we had a really interesting conversation prior to this too about the pro component, and I'm excited because we got a lot of things we can talk about and really get through today.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Perfect. Maybe you want to just get us started with, what is College Prep?
Absolutely. So College Prep is something that's just in its second year. And I would basically say I it's a wild experiment. It's essentially my laboratory to share evidence-based coaching ideas to the whole basketball world. So, I mean, essentially our mission statement, why we exist, is to show what evidence-informed coaching looks like, underpinned by a transformational approach to coaching. So we have 20 players from all over the world, mostly European, but we have 3 players from New Zealand and 1 player from the Turks and Caicos Islands in the Caribbean. So it's a very diverse setting, boys aged between 16 and 19 years old. And our goal is basically to develop them as best we can for what comes next in their life, whether that is going to college or in America, playing professionally, or going on to some other form of university kind of education combined with basketball anywhere else in the world. And we're 10 months almost year round. So I think it's really unique because I just have so much time here. And it's a very kind of unique ecological niche, I would say, in terms of I have a complete full reign to experiment and to basically do what I want. And that's led to some really cool things emerging, which now I get to talk about on cool podcasts like this one.
Yep, maybe we can dive right into there. What are you experimenting with? Because Dom already dropped two very yeah, exciting words in the intro that most people maybe never heard of. So maybe you can give us a little a short introduction so we all know what you're talking about.
Absolutely. So it all starts with having a theoretical understanding for how we approach basketball, not just me as a coach, but also how we, you know, view skill, what skill is, what we construe player development to mean. So for us, basically, you know, I think in the basketball world, and it's not the fault of coaches, it's just, you know, a variety of different kind of constraints which had led to this being the situation we're in. But, you know, many basketball personnel will not kind of have a firm understanding as to what skill is. And I think if you ask them what it is, you'll get a lot of different responses, and you'll typically get things referencing techniques or very biomechanical kind of particular movements as to what coaches believe are important. Whereas for us, we view skill as the relationship between a player and the environment. And critically, skill, it's not something that a player possesses or owns. It's something which is adaptive, and it's always changing in light of different constraints. So this is where, you know, we look at what approach, what methodology can we use to view our players, to view the team, to view interactions. And this is where the constraints that approach, kind of underpinned by ecological dynamics, comes into play. And what this does is it gives us a lens for which we can view the game, and it gives us ideas in terms of how we can coach basketball and develop the players in an ecological way. I mean, I think that leads pretty well into explaining what the CLA is. Would you like me, guys?
It's exactly,
would you like me to go naturally to that?
I wanted to ask you anyway.
Perfect. So, the roots of the CLA, first we have to understand ecological dynamics, because that basically underpins the CLA. And the CLA is more of a practical method for coaches to use. Ecological dynamics is basically the theory behind it and why we have this specific method. So it comes from two fields, and that is dynamic systems theory and ecological psychology. So when you mold both things, naturally you get ecological dynamics in the name, right? Mm-hmm. Half and half. So if I start with dynamical systems theory, this comes primarily from a lot of the work done by a guy called Nikolai Bernstein. And a lot of his research occurred in the Soviet Union. He was a Soviet scientist, and it all began when he was commissioned by the Soviet Union to explore productivity and basically exploring how to have blacksmiths become more proficient and efficient in terms of how they're producing, you know, materials in the Soviet days. And basically, Bernstein's research had huge implications on the motor learning world, because he basically coined the phrase repetition without repetition, and the fact that no movement is ever repeatable. Yet what we typically see in the motor learning world in terms of all sports is coaches doing movements where they're very similar, not much repetition without repetition. It's repetition after repetition, where moves are kind of taught and then reproduced. And Bernstein basically looked at how the human body moves and used the phrase degrees of freedom in terms of how is it that basketball players, when they can move their bodies in so many different ways, there are so many different possibilities for how they use bones, ligaments, soft tissues. How is it that basketball players control those degrees of freedom to produce the coordinated sequences we'd see in a game, whether that's shooting a layup, shooting the ball, defending, whatever? And Bernstein basically suggested that it was the concept of self-organization as a result of interacting constraints that leads to movement. So what this is critical, guys, because it means that there is no kind of stored motor pattern that players or us as humans have in our heads for how we move, right? And this applies to everything in life, not just basketball. So what this means is that constraints impact self-organization and the body will move as a result of those, as opposed to having a stored motor pattern like a robot that they're just going to be able to execute at one moment in time. So I think that's kind of the idea of dynamical systems theory in a nutshell, described as quickly as I can without being too lengthy. It's basically self-organization tendencies, degrees of freedom, repetition without repetition, right? But now we got to look at how is it that self-organization actually happens, right? So players have to be perceiving something and acting on that accordingly, which affects the self-organization, right? And this is ecological psychology, the idea that players are constantly interacting with their environment to move, and they are perceiving things, and it's direct perception. You know, they don't need to have a stored program or have a mental model to which they process to account for how they move. So a lot of this work comes from ecological psychologists, Brunswick and Gibson, and they coined, Gibson in particular, he coined the phrase an affordance. So an affordance is basically an opportunity or an invitation for action. So if we picture like a pick and roll setting in a game, based on different constraints and different situations, like where the defense are, location of teammates, time and score, different affordances will present themselves. For instance, the ball handler might have an affordance to reject if there's space. They might have an affordance to shoot a pull-up three if there's space to do so. Or maybe another player their teammate starts rolling and uses the space to get behind the defense on a short roll. So the ball handler acts on the affordance to pass. So the whole idea is that the game is basically comprised of lots of these different affordances, aka invitations for action. And players are basically having to perceive these in order to act and produce the skilled sequences we'd see. So another key part of this is the idea of perception and action coupling, which comes from ecological psychology. So it's basically players perceiving affordances and acting accordingly. Perception action coupling is always occurring, guys. So it's not a case of perceive then act. It's a constant process, because players will perceive and actually like move their head in order to gain information. Take that pick and roll example. Maybe they move their head and they see the weak side help defenders really pulled in. And then, you know, they might act accordingly by making a skip pass. So key thing within ecological psychology is perception, action coupling, affordances, and the fact that players have to attune to information in their environment to act. So basically, when we combine both those fields, we get ecological dynamics, which is taking those and adapting them specifically to sport, right? So if we think about, you know, this is the theory for how humans move, right? This is the facts. This is how it is. So then it becomes a question of if this is what we know about the human system and all of this, how can we coach in a way which aligns with this, right? And this is where the constraint-led approach comes in, and it gives coaches an actual means to provide these, to create affordances in practice, to respect the role of self-organization. So as opposed to teaching all these techniques and using explicit instruction, coaches can design activities in the form of small-sided games for their players, where there is repetition out repetition. Players have realistic affordances. And, you know, subsequently, skills can emerge in this environment, which is obviously a very different approach to the traditional style in coaching, which is the dominant approach we still see used today.
Okay. A lot of stuff that we can dive deeper into. So many very interesting and cool topics. Thank you. But I think it was really good to follow the way you explained it. But let's try to dive deeper into certain areas that you already mentioned. And I think maybe for us and for our listeners to understand, it might help to reference some of this stuff we already heard in our podcast. Because I think, first of all, the evidence-based you were talking about, Dom, we had... I forgot his name on the
Stefan
podcast. Stefan Dahl, obviously, I'm so sorry, on the podcast, who talked about this. So we know kind of what the idea behind this. And then I remember us talking about you, Dom, about your strength coaching, and where we were like, hey, maybe where we were seeing parallels between the business world and strength coaching in terms of where is the degree of freedom there. Players need to be autonomous. They need to make decisions. Hey, I feel like this is good for me. I want to do this. This might not be in the textbook, but I felt good yesterday, so I want to do this again. And I think that's what we heard there. And I think one key element in this is what you said at the end, is the coaches themselves, because they need to play. When I was coaching in business world, we always had this saying of the delegation poker. So how much freedom do you give as a leader to superiors? It was back in the day. In the agile world, you have this. And I think here, that's the main thing I hear of your approach, that coaches give more freedom to the players and they have more of this setup they can control. But within this setup, you can do whatever you want, basically. And I think in business world, that was really tough for leaders to let this happen, because you need to be patient, you need to let go. Mistakes need to happen. It probably takes some time. Maybe you can share some experiences you made personally, or you saw with other coaches that you worked with trying to implement this.
Absolutely, Leonard. I think that's a great connection to what you're talking about in the business world. And I'd say this, I think it's a paradigm shift in terms of how we view the role of a coach, a trainer, you know, anyone in an organization, because as opposed to this very coach-centric view where the coach is the center of everything, and, you know, teaching, you know, we see the coach having all the knowledge in terms of what they think players need to have, how they need to move. So instead of being, I'd say, instructors, we are more architects of very rich kind of learning environments which contain these affordances. And a key part of this is appreciating the fact that as coaches, we may not always know best in terms of, you know, what is optimal for a player. And this links back to the constraint-set approach, where we look at skill emerging as a result of three types of constraint. Individual, which are things related to the player, such as their wingspan, their height, their vertical jump, as well as their perceptual skills. And then we have task constraints in terms of the rules of basketball and what we'd actually see in a 5-on-5 game, but then also the practice environment in terms of the games you're using, the scoring system, all of this. And then environmental constraints, like the wider socio-cultural landscape. Of course, it extends to physical things like the surface, the lighting levels. But for me, I do think like the forms of life in terms of, you know, maybe you're growing up in a country where basketball was extremely popular, like Lithuania, versus you know, somewhere else. So the whole idea with the CLA is that coaches appreciate the role that these three constraints have, and they're always interacting. So these constraints are ever present, and that's why skills emerge. So obviously, if we appreciate that, we quickly understand that it does not make sense to approach the practice whereby we are instructing and always telling the player what to do. And instead, you know, it's ecological in nature. That's, you know, I think that's why ecological dynamics, it's, yes, it's complicated to understand, but the root of it is that it's ecological, it's organic. So we're creating lots of different environments through very, you know, smart and creative constraints, which leads to players being more skilled, and they will come up with solutions which are optimal for how they move and, you know, the constraints that are affecting them in a way.
Could you also enlarge on one topic? Maybe, Leonard, maybe you also, you know, you've been playing basketball for your whole life, basically. And myself, yeah, I did that as well. And in the past, how coaches taught me things was through technique practice. Yeah, they wanted me to do things a certain way in a 1-on-0 setting. And then we would always think that I could bring these certain techniques to a game. This was, you know, this was the transfer was always the goal. But just looking at
But never supported.
Yeah, but looking at myself, I really struggled with that. Where, you know, where do we maybe missed the boat there? Where do you think this went wrong? And it's probably also according to the perception action coupling, because we missed something there. We jumped like two steps ahead, I think.
Yeah, that is exactly it. So basically, the role of perception and action coupling, and how that's completely foundational to any skill appearing in a game, well, that's not respected or accounted for when you do any type of practice without defense. And I call that decomposing practice, because basically what you're doing is you are removing key information that players would need to perceive, aka the defense, right? Because the defense obviously determines the actions and the motor skills, aka the movements that appear. So, and the big problem is that this is coaches are assuming that players can just plug it, aka plug the movement in at the right time. Yeah. But none of the research and the evidence base aligns with that. It's the opposite, you know, based on dynamical systems through an ecological psychology. So this is why I think I don't blame coaches, because it's a result of many, many factors in terms of coaches coach, how they were coached as players, coach education schemes. Like, there are very few programs in the world talking about this stuff, you know. Then, of course, you've got conceptions as to what you think effective coaching is. And that's why, you know, at College Prep, I don't have someone over me telling me how to do things. So imagine if I was in a more traditional environment, I'd never be able to do some of these things, because I'd just view the game from a completely different perspective. So I think it's the key thing is that there is no black box theory, and players can't just plug it in. So and as part of this, coaches have to appreciate the fact, and this is very difficult to comprehend, but there's no such thing as muscle memory, and there's no such thing as one optimal technique. Now, absolutely, there are some commonalities, and there are some things, I call them rate limiters, which could limit a player biomechanically, of course. But the key thing is, you know, they could be very different and very context specific to each player's. So, for instance, when it comes to shooting, there are so many different ways to shoot the ball, right? So we would focus at College Prep, we focus more on the outcome in terms of shooting with a good arc that gives the ball a chance of scoring as a brad, which stands for back of the rim and down. But how they do that in terms of self-organization, we will not be concerned with. Now, if we see something biomechanically that is an attractor, which is an attractor in an ecological landscape, is basically a very stable coordination tendency that a player might not be able to get out of. So if we see something that maybe is not allowing a player to get a good arc on their shot, that's when we use the CLA to basically try and get them out of that attractor state. So it could be as simple as, you know, one example we had was one attractor for a player coming, joining us late in the season a month ago, was he had a very slow release with his shot, right? And because it was also so slow, but the arc was very flat. And I believe that came as a result of lots of one-on-zero shooting. So all we did is we designed lots of one-on-one activities whereby a defender was closing out. And sure enough, what that does is that task design means that they have to shoot the ball quicker, and they also shoot it higher in order to shoot it over a defender who's closing out. So, you know, over time, we still got lots of repetition, but it was repetition without repetition. Because he'd be changing location every shot, shooting from a different range. A defender would be coming from a different angle. So naturally, that helped get him out of that attractor state and self-organize, reaching a new coordination that was more functional. So that is a great example of how, yes, you know, I'm not saying that roll the balls out and just let anything happen. That would be a very vague approach. That is not what this approach is, the approach I advocate for. It's very highly specific, but at the same time, leaving room for players to self-organize. But the coach has to know a lot, but it's a different type of knowledge. It's more being attuned to how the players are interacting and moving, as opposed to having a model as to what you think a specific technique should look like.
Yeah. And I think also I also watched a little bit the All-Star Weekend this past weekend, and I watched the 3-point contest, and I watched Halliburton shoot. And if you look at that type of shot, I think when you just see the shot without the result, you wouldn't say this guy can shoot. In the first set, like when I saw him play at first, I was like, this is definitely not a shooter. And all of a sudden, no, it's just his technique. He found it, and the result is very good. I think that's another good example.
It's an amazing point.
Yeah.
It's an amazing point. I was thinking of referencing that, but that is the best example there is, because, you know, a coach is saying that that is not functional. Absolutely, it's functional. You know, look at the results he has.
Yeah.
And the, you know, how he's kind of self-organizing to that movement is a result of a very unique, probably an extensive bibliography. You know, skills have histories, as Bernstein said. So, you know, it could be maybe like in Steph Curry's instance, when he was younger, the hoop he practiced on at his grandfather's, in his grandparents' house, was very high and it was very hard. So naturally it meant if you hit the rim, it would never go in. So naturally what happened? Well, it affected self-organization. He had to shoot the ball with greater arc in order to solve the task goal of scoring a basket. So this is, you know, the fascinating thing that, you know, this is how skills form as a result of all these constraints. And this is why it makes no sense for a coach, especially, you know, coaches, if they're just working with a new player, they have no idea what their history is. You know, what are the considerations and the constraints that led to a player moving a particular way? So this is where, you know, by using the CLA, we're really accounting for this kind of non-linearity in development, in terms of humans learn things at different rates. It's just the way it is. You know, if you have kids, you know, did all your kids learn to walk precisely 3 years, 2 months, 1 day, you know, into their lives? Absolutely not. But the problem is, this is how coaches and basketball personnel in general are approaching the game, in a linear fashion where they have to do things at certain times, have these techniques, and it's just completely kind of not aligned with just the science in terms of how we are as humans, basically. Dirk Nowitzki is another great example of it, as a shooter.
Or somebody else we had on the podcast, Dom, Mike Stockton, with his eye issue. He, one of his eyes, he cannot move to the inside or outside. His head movement was way off, and his shot changed the way he played, but it worked for him, and it really threw you off in practice, because I practiced against him. It was really tough to guard him. And another point I want to get at in what you were saying about the coach's role is the psychological part behind it, because it makes total sense what you say. But what does that leave the coach with? If you, like, show a player the right technique and maybe it somehow works, you as a coach, you get the praise, let's say. You're I know best. It's, you know, I helped you. And this is something I think a lot of coaches or humans in general would obviously look for, because it's human nature, I would say. But the way you explain it, and that might be why it's hard for you to implement, is the players might not even understand what you did for them. How your example with the shot, with the closeouts and stuff, because you have to put yourself in the back and you're not the front runner of why this player is actually playing better. No, it's the player itself. And I think that's key point.
It's a huge point. And I think, I mean, I get a lot of confidence from having an understanding of the theory. And this is why, you know, a lot of people in the basketball world say, you know, you're trying to make basketball some type of nuclear equation, but it's not. It's just the fact that the theory makes me even more confident in my approach, because I know that what I'm doing has a rationale behind it, and it gives me the basis for knowing, you know, how I coach, and I can actually justify it. Because if you don't have a theoretical framework for how you coach, how can you justify, you know, what you're doing? You can't, right? It's just all opinion and myths, which is what I'm trying to get the basketball world to move away from. And obviously, a key part of that is people understanding that the role of the coach is very different. So if most general managers in the basketball world, whether that's in the NBA or in Europe, if they came into one of my practices or player development sessions, they might be like, what the hell is this? Right? And you know, probably a lot of, you know, traditional minded programs, you know, they probably would not hire me now with basketball in the current, you know, situation it is. But what I'm excited about is how we're kind of blowing this whole system up. And in 10, 15, 20 years, the ecosystem is going to be completely different. And I think this is why, exposing kind of these ideas to more decision makers in basketball helps them understand, you know, what this approach is. And then they're going to look for people who have a very different skill set compared to the traditional approach. And I think one great example, I know Fabian Vilmater in Hamburg, right? I can't remember Fabian's exact role in the leadership there, but he is a great example. He was obviously a youth national team coach, but he understands all of this stuff and he does it. So it's like the more that we get situations like that where kind of the front office staff kind of see the value to this, it's huge. And there's another example, an NBA team I did a presentation for last month. You know, one of their assistant GMs has probably the best understanding of this topic in the NBA. So it's like, I think we just have to give it time, because gradually as these ideas become more widespread and people understand that there's such a strong evidence base behind this stuff, naturally people's kind of practices and the way they approach things are just going to change.
I bet I know what NBA team this is.
Yeah.
Can you say it, or should we do this behind the scenes?
We could do it offline. I wish I could say, but unfortunately, I can't.
We'll do this offline. And one point I wanted to add to this, and then Dom can shoot the next question, is the front offices in general, to put it like this, who becomes head coach in pro sports? Guys that have a clear vision of what they do and how they want to do it. Because that, you know, they act like you can plan success somehow. And, you know, they and that's how they get this job, because the front office wants somebody like that. That's what they've been looking for. And I'm also very much looking forward for the change you just kind of described, because I think that goes with it. And then it becomes, again, more player-centric, let's say. And I really like that idea.
I mean, I can talk about, Leonard, basically, like, I can talk about the ideas I presented to the NBA team without going into specifics. But basically, it was exactly on that, in terms of how can you use the constraint-led approach as a unifying framework, not just for what your coaches do, but the whole franchise. And that's where it becomes intriguing, because I think there's one baseball team doing that right now who I can't list, the Pittsburgh Pirates, who have gone completely ecological, bringing in the right people to do it. But imagine, you know, if, you know, as opposed to just confining the ideas of the CLA to basketball, you apply it to athletic performance, you apply it to analytics, apply it to how the front office scout and make trade decisions, how you develop your staff. And this, to me, is the hugely exciting thing behind kind of what I guess I can say it, well, behind what I'm pioneering in the basketball world, because I think that's what I'm doing. And just, you know, the scope and the crazy potential that is out there, which hasn't been fulfilled yet, to me, it's staggering. And that's what I'm really excited to help organizations fulfill, you know, at some moment in time.
Yeah.
Alex, one thing that is really interesting for me, because I'm in the pro basketball world, and I know that, you know, I wouldn't say a lot, but I know of a few coaches that who are listening to our podcast, and in regards to the constraint-led approach, maybe you can give us an example. I know you did that before, but maybe let's try to think of an example of the constraint-led approach in a team setting, like in a team practice environment, where the whole team is practicing. I also have one for myself. I wanted to present that, and let's see what you think of that. But maybe you have an example as well, because what we said so far, I mean, I think constraints should guide self-organization trying to push the athletes away from certain solutions. But at the same time, they should look for other solutions, right? That's how I understood it. But maybe in a team practice setting, maybe you have an example of the CLA.
Absolutely. Great point. So I think a really interesting thing too, I should probably mention, Dom, is that even traditional coaches are using the CLA, whether they like it or not. And this is the irony, because the CLA basically accounts for how skills emerge, because skills are emergent. There's no way around that. The key difference is the coaches who are using the CLA underpinned by ecological dynamics and the coaches who are not. And that's like 0.1%, right? So anyway, what would a CLA team practice look like underpinned with ecological dynamics and those ideas? Essentially, it would be, you know, and I think this is a good time where I can mention some of the principles of nonlinear kind of pedagogy, which would be repetition without repetition. So any type of activity where there is repetition without repetition and different things emerging. So for instance, a lot of things like a three-man weave drill, spot shooting, that is not repetition without repetition because it's the same thing repeated every time, right? So rep without rep would be one. Another one would be external focus of attention. So this would be, you know, instead of coaches using internal feedback, such as bend your knees, do this, they externalize it and they focus more on the outcome as opposed to break. And the idea behind that is basically external focus, it promotes self-organization. Whereas internal feedback, like we spoke about with degrees of freedom, the player starts thinking about how to organize their body. And we don't want that, right? A key feature would be manipulation of constraints, and that would typically be task constraints. So for instance, let's say, and I like the best way to do this is to help coaches understand this is talk about things that they might be doing already, which have similarities. So, you know, maybe something like they do a three-man weave into some type of live activity, like a live two-on-one coming back. Right. Well, in that two-on-one, you know, there's some basic manipulation of constraints. I would, of course, advocate for not even needing the three-man weave part, but basically any type of activity where there's some live component would be manipulation of constraints. Now, I haven't had a chance to speak with him in person, but I think Thomas Isolo is a great example because I've listened to some of his podcasts. And everything he was saying to me is what we're kind of speaking about, maybe without, you know, some of the very specific terminology I've used, but he's a great example of someone doing this. And you know, I think his success speaks for itself. So we've got manipulation constraints and then we've got perception and action coupling, right? So any type of activity which features that would be, you know, using an ecological approach in a team practice. So this is where, as opposed to doing things like 5-on-0, I would say instead just add defenders. You can just put three defenders in there. And those three defenders will, you know, allow for variability to occur. Players have to perceive things. And it's going to mean that the same movement pattern isn't done the same way every time. So the simplest thing coaches can do is just add some type of defender to any drill they're doing. And it becomes, instead of it becoming a drill, it's a small-sided game. And now we're kind of using some more ecological approaches within the team practice.
Because there was one situation lately where I also had to think about all this. We were just playing a scrimmage game, and I think it's not a secret that you like your players to shoot corner threes. Yeah, I think I can say that. This is not a basketball secret, and I think it's also not a basketball secret. Secret that you don't really want your players take contested long twos with the defender right in front of you.
I think you'd be surprised as to how bewildering that information is to still many coaches around the world. Like I'll be completely honest. Teams, unfortunately, I'm at the youth level, but you know, pretty much all the teams, and I know a lot of coaches think I'm weird because we don't shoot contested mid-range jump shots and fadeaways. But again, it's like, that's not science. It's very, very basic maths, you know?
But what we did now, and I think this is a manipulation of a task constraint. What we did now on 5-on-5, we basically told them, hey guys, okay, corner threes, you get 4 points. Layups, you get 3 points. Contested long twos, when you still make it, only 1 point. So then I'm thinking, okay, this is a constraint because it, you know, it eliminates certain possibilities or options for actions. But at the same time, you want them to self-organize and find different solutions that maybe help us better getting better shots. So
what you just gave, Dom, is the best example. And I'll be, you know, I can share secrets. That is basically what you just described is the first thing I do with any team that I'm head coaching. We basically get our players attuned to the advantages of taking better shots, which are more efficient and more high value from a point per possession standpoint, as opposed to low value shots. So we, like, what I typically do is play like continuous 3-on-3 just mm-hmm. because they get more repetitions within the 3-on-3, even a 5-on-5. And I would say, okay, exactly as you just said, I put a point system on the shots we want, heavily weighted to getting rim finishes, fouls, and threes, and kind of trying to minimize everything mm-hmm. else unless it's a late clock situation. And then, you know, what we're doing is it's constraining to afford.
Exactly, yeah.
Because it's creating different affordances for players to find solutions as to what they can do to get those shots. And then, you know, this, before I even show and start to kind of implement my principles of play, that activity in itself gives the players autonomy and it guides the things which happen next, because naturally they start to self-organize and they would start to use triggers, things like pick and roll, off-ball screens, and they would start to work on their dominoes habits, which is basically, you know, a Russ McMain's term I use for how you play with an advantage. And this all happens naturally, ecologically, without me having to waste time instructing, telling them what I want to see. So that would be like any team I take, that is basically the first thing you can do to drastically improve your team. And you will see your players do amazing movements in order to become more skilled, finishing at the rim or getting behind the three to shoot the three.
Yeah. I also have another nice example of self-organization, because back, I think it was 5-6 years ago when the 3x3 started happening, you know, the scene. I was at the luck of playing for the European Championship of Universities in Portugal. And it was like basically the first year where it really started. And we came there as a team who had never played 3x3. And so what I observed during this tournament in the beginning, I think everybody was a little bit unsure about the different rules and stuff. And what I watched, actually Lithuania did, because they're also usually ahead of the snake in basketball. When I, for example, had like a breakthrough layup, instead of trying to send the help, they would just let me do the layup, go for the rebound, and have somebody set up in the corner already while I'm taking my layup to get the outlet pass and shoot that open three from the corner. Because they were like, all right, you get that layup, but we still score a three at a very high percentage. So please. And that's like, again, the great self-organization.
Example. Yeah. Great example.
So we talked about, I think now we get a pretty clear idea of what you're trying to advocate. Now I want to get a little bit at your job in Paris, where you work with this in pro sports with a pro team who play in Eurocup. So, you know, a lot of money involved, a lot of pressure. And I think one key opponent to me of this approach is also having patience a little bit. What are usually the main points for... like, how was it for you to implement it there? How long did it take? What problems did you face? And maybe also in general, what are usually the main points of criticism you get from other coaches, let's say, who say, hey, we've been doing this for 10, 20 years, we've been successful, why change it now?
Absolutely. So, firstly, I'm lucky to work for an amazing boss in terms of the head coach, Will Weaver, and you know, I think for me, it all starts with the head coach, and you can't implement any of this without, you know, like speaking to some NBA teams, the front offices are starting to get this stuff and they want it. But, you know, and it's not the head coach's fault, but they've obviously, you know, they'd be comfortable doing coaching a very different way their whole lives. So they're not just going to suddenly change with some English guy coming in talking about evidence-based coaching ideas. You know, it's not pragmatic. And I understand that. So instead, it's more, you know, waiting for coaches like Will when they get to head coaching opportunities, and then they can drive the change. And, you know, one of the first things Will said to me when we were planning the season was, I don't want to do a single activity all year, whether that's one, like 1-0, 5-0, any activity without defense. And it's true. We haven't, you know, the only, other than when players just shoot about. So, Will has a very firm understanding of this stuff. And, you know, I think, to looking at environmental constraints, what's the reason for that? Well, A, just individual constraints in terms of, I think, having a thirst for knowledge, which he obviously has. But then two, like, he spent some time coaching in Australia, and obviously a lot of the ecological dynamics kind of ideas and the skill acquisition space, there's some really good work being done there. So naturally, I think he was more exposed and actually got to learn what this stuff was about. So, you know, basically, I help Will with the practice planning for the team practices, which is obviously a big task. I really enjoy that responsibility. And then obviously Will adapts accordingly, implements, you know, like any head coach, the way he wants to play, his vision for the game, all of that. So, but what we've done is, you know, taken the game principles that Will wanted, and they're all aligned with ecological dynamics, because it's not, you know, set based in terms of just players running sets robotically. It's all based on triggers and just players acting on affordances, right? As opposed to us controlling all of that. So it all starts with that. So the style of play has to align with ecological dynamics, which it does. And then following that, we design practices that obviously can help shape those game principles, but through an ecological manner. So it's, you know, it's small sided games, variability. So even on, you know, the challenge is obviously travel, especially with the Euro Cup schedule. But even on the low stress days, you know, we have variability. Now, I can't talk about specifics as to what we do, because, you know, that's obviously private to us at Paris Basketball. But all the things I spoke about in terms of this, like having real affordances, repetition out repetition, that would be evident in every practice, which is really, really cool to be a part of and know that we're doing this stuff. So I think too, like Will spoke about it actually in a recent podcast, in terms of the vision is, it's a long-term vision that we're committed to. It's not focused just on the game that's happening next Sunday, right? That's not what it is. It's, you know, we've got some really exciting players who could be great NBA players in the future. And I think it aligns amazingly with that goal of Paris Basketball developing, you know, amazing players from France. And this is what the ecological approach does. We're developing players for the future and all the games they're going to have in years' time, as opposed to just a complete focus on game preparation and what's happening next week, which is, I think, something many professional teams fall into the trap of.
Dom, I just had to think of the open offense we ran with BJ Göttingen back in the day with Johan. Also an offense where it was very free-flowing, no sets really. I'm not sure if he still runs it or ran it in Bamberg, but that was also something. Also there, we needed to have the patience in the beginning. And that's some point I want to get at also from the player's view. How do they perceive it when you come in? And because usually they're used to other types of practice. How quickly do they adapt? What do they usually struggle with maybe?
It's really interesting, because I see very different behaviors when I'm in Paris with the players at prep. And I think that's just because the players at prep, like, they kind of didn't know another way. Or they did, but it was their contact time to the traditional approach was limited, right? And they've, you know, very quickly changed and become more adaptive. Whereas in Paris, obviously, some of those players have been exposed to a very different coaching approach from their whole careers. So I think and it's really interesting, because when you see like some key behaviors in the game, or I'd say like unfavorable tendencies or coordination solutions, I believe that really comes from what they've experienced in the past, right? So in essence, players love it because they get to play and it's basketball, and they're not having to listen to a coach instruct, yell at them, tell them what they should be doing. So naturally they can express themselves. And I think The biggest kind of learning curve for me was getting the players used to small-sided games because, you know, and not having predetermined movements and knowing what the outcome is. So getting them used to that, especially in the preseason, I remember it was really interesting for me, and I really had to do much simpler constraint manipulations than what I do in prep. Like in prep, we do some pretty crazy things, and that's because the players can do it because they're, you know, they're immersed in this, and we have a lot of practices. Whereas obviously, you know, we had to scale it back at the start and approach our small-sided games in a more simple manner that just fostered all the things we've spoken about. And, you know, now it's cool because we're able to try some really cool things. And yeah, I think the players love it because it's different. They get to play it. And, you know, as well, guys, they see the improvement because you can't compare. And this is the thing that's most exciting. You just cannot compare the improvement of this approach to a traditional approach. It's just two completely incompatible approaches. And I think, you know, naturally, because you are playing basketball, players just improve so much through an ecological approach to coaching. Yeah,
there's one topic I really would like to touch on is the topic of warm-ups. I just looked it up. As for now, we had 107 team practices so far this season, like really team practices where we have contact practice and stuff like that. So that basically means I had 107 team warm-ups that I conduct. Yeah. And I like to say it to my colleagues a lot of time that, you know, I tend to get fed up with my warm-ups because, you know, I almost hate them.
Sure.
But I don't really hate them. But, you know, the way I set them up now is completely different to what I have used to be doing in the past. So for me now is, okay, in the beginning, we mobilize some joints. That's what we do. Not too long, because I still think this is not wrong to do it. Then we have like a short part, really short, of some dynamic stretches, not repetitive, because we talked about degrees of freedom, variability, and stuff like that. I basically ask our guys to always do the moves in a different way. Position your foot a little forward, a little backward. I never ask them to come up with this technique all the time. And then we flow into things where sometimes I see my guys just shaking their heads because in their mind, you know, everything still has to be like according to a standard, you know? And right now I really throw stuff at them. And I could sometimes really see the guys shaking their head like basically telling me, what the hell are we doing here? I let them hop with the hands behind the back, the hands in the front. I give them, I tell them, okay, guys, you have to now go to the other side, but you give me right leg 3 contacts, left leg 1, figure it out. Stuff like this. So complete randomness, yeah? And in the end, we always, almost always, because our coach also really likes it, we come up, we have a small-sided game. And this is something I really started focusing on at the start of this season. We basically almost always have a game. And this led to the fact that players are now coming to me before the start of practice. And they're like, oh, Dom, what kind of a game do we play today? And even one guy told me, oh, this is the best part of practice, Dom, when we play a game. And then I'm like, okay, good. Then I might be doing something right. But obviously, I don't randomly throw games at them. I try to come up with games where they have to replicate movements that they are about to face in basketball practice. And, you know, we all know that basketball practices are messy. Nothing happens like not the same movement probably doesn't happen twice, stuff like that. But what I have figured now in these warm-ups, and that's what I've done different in the years before, there is like not when we play these games, oh my God, there's noise in the gym. They are going at it. Yeah. I can just give you an example of one game that I played. Yep. I'm not sure if you heard about this. I think it is just awesome. Maybe some other coaches can use it for their practices. And I have to give credit to one of our coaches. His name is Hubbo because he introduced me to it. And it's basically you basically have two teams, like in our case, one orange, one white. And you know, this game where you have a basketball and where you have to complete 10 passes without the other team deflecting the basketball. So, and if you complete these 10 passes, you have a point. But what we did, we put the basketball out. So there's no basketball. There's just an imaginary basketball. So let's say we use the size of the court. They run somewhere, and I will just tell them, okay, possession, like the orange team is in possession of the basketball. And then I say, okay, I don't know, Kaya has the basketball. So what Kaya now has to do, the other team needs to try to tag him while he is in possession of the ball. He has no ball, but he can pass the ball by calling out a name of, you know, of one of his teammates. So then he can basically run, and he has to run away from the guy who's trying to tag him, but he has to pass the ball to one other guy who obviously has to move, because if this other guy receives the pass, he also cannot get tagged. And then I think my task, I think I have to get them ready for practice. And when you watch this, the amount of noise in the gym is just incredible. They run at a pace that they would typically never run in a warm-up. And they just go after it because obviously small-sided games, it's fun. They want to win. And then I think if I can get this done in my warm-up, then I hope I did a better job as if I put them on the line and tell them, okay, guys, run to the midline and run back. Because now we have movements. They're about to face in basketball practice. Yeah, it is reflective. They have to react on the other guys. And they have to make decisions in short amount of time. And this is just one example. This is how we in general operate with all these games. We always, like within our colleagues, we always talk a lot about these games because every team is using them. But then in that case, I think I just prepare a better warm-up as if, like we talked about before, I would ask them to go through movements always the same time. Do you also use a lot of games in warm-ups?
Yeah, I really enjoyed listening to that, Dom, and I'm actually going to try that next practice.
Oh, you should. Let me know how
it works. Really cool idea. I mean, for me, that whole approach you described aligns with an ecological approach, and this is why, you know, I think the biggest advantages of the teams that can apply it to everything and not just the coaching. So for me, I view the warm-up as opening up the degrees of freedom. And like you said, it's preparing players for the movements they're about to do in the practice. And the biggest, you know, problem with the traditional approach is you're not doing that. And it's I'd say it's more dangerous because players are not doing any of the movements that are unpredictable and inherent within basketball itself. And also what you're doing is you're putting all the pressure on the same joints because you're doing the same movements every time. So no wonder, you know, increasing like the chances of repetitive injuries and things like ankle sprains occurring because players aren't adapting and having, you know, receiving affordances where they can actually work on all that stuff. So within the warm-up, I think it's key that it's variable and the same as what we talk about in the practice, things like repetition at repetition. Like you said, just getting players to do different movements is one way of doing that. And then having loads of like different tag variations, things like that. So, and like you said, we always have something unique for the warm-up that the players don't know what it is. Could be playing football one time, could be handball, mm-hmm. but we very rarely do the same thing twice in a season. And it's just by having so many different things, it makes the players excited for practice. You start on a good note. There's energy in the gym. And it's, for me, the most boring part of my coaching in the past has been during what the athletic trainer does. And it's, I find it difficult sitting there because I know what they're doing is a waste of time because it is, and it's not valuable and it's boring. Whereas instead, you know, if you start doing all this stuff in the warm up, you know, it's helping your players more. It's getting them more attuned to what happens in the game. They're developing their athletic capabilities. That's exactly what we want.
Yeah. Mm. One other example, I just quickly, for example, let's say I want them to perform accelerations, like 2-3 getaway steps, something like that. What I could do, I could put them on the baseline and tell them, okay, here, do 3 acceleration steps and then go back, do it all over again. This would be so boring, yeah? First of all, nobody would really do it because, you know, it's just boring. But what I then did...
Exactly.
And it is so incredibly easy to get these guys... doing something where they don't really feel that they are doing it. What I now do is, let's say you have 6 guys on the one basket, right, or right side, they face the other basket. And I just tell them, here, throw up your basketball, it's one bounce, and then you have to go for a layup on the other basket. So what do you think is going to happen? They're all smiling, they're like, oh, wow, really nice. They throw the basketball up. And then I tell them, you know what, throw the basketball up with your weak hand. Throw the basketball up behind your head. Let your teammate throw the basketball up. Let your teammate throw a Hail Mary pass. You have to finish 1-2 contact layup. So then they're all so focused on the basketball that they don't even think about what they're actually doing. And then I think this is smart coaching when it comes side of work. I at least hope. But yeah.
No, I 100% agree. And it's like, it's obviously completely different to how most athletic coaches in basketball approach to work. But that to me is where, you know, the merits in this approach are just evident. I think anyone listening, you don't have to have a knowledge of athletic performance, strength and condition, whatever, to see the huge value to this approach.
Yeah. So I want to end this shortly, but I want to end this with an example maybe of constraints. So I was thinking, I think we have a lot of young players listening to this podcast growing up in Europe, I would say. So I think the constraints in the summer, at least how I experienced them back in the day, were oftentimes the gym is not open, but I can somehow get access to a hoop because they're spread around town, and I could just get my bike and my ball, and I could go to find a hoop. But I was always a little bit, okay, what do I do there? What do I do now? If we say, okay, maybe just spot up shooting is not the right thing. Do you have something for this specific setup of being alone that players could take out of this?
Absolutely.
Episode?
So it's what I'd encourage players to look at is I'm actually doing a research project right now, and I'm looking at environmental constraints and how those shape skills. And what I'm specifically looking at is Brazilian soccer and the impact of poverty and especially informal playing opportunities, i.e. street football, it's called Paleda, where players just self-organize in terms of have different teams with different rules. They play on weird surfaces, on different spaces, and just amazing things happen. So in essence, like, you can improve enormously as a player through free play, which is not in a structured coaching environment. And I would actually say, especially for youth players, the more you can get of that versus structured coaching, if the coaching is not done in a way which aligns all the ideas we've said today, it would be far more beneficial to you as a player to just play with your friends in a park or even by yourself if you get kind of variable practice as opposed to going to those team practices. Now, you know, I don't want to generate controversy and have players, you know, stop going to team practices, you know, wherever they are. But what you can do is you can just go to wherever there's a court and think about variability. So can you just, like, something I used to do as a player was I'd play in my garden on both, and my hoop had like both grass and then there was like a tarmac area. So obviously that afforded different movement solutions. And I'd just like improvise and I'd like imagine myself in a game, like having to hit particular shots. And naturally what it was is I was always shooting from different spots, right? And I actually became a good shooter because of that, not because of any of the shooting practice I received from my club. And then the key thing would be, if you can, actually play with friends and play loads of one-on-one, two-on-ones, two-on-twos, kind of, you know, whatever format you can use, and think of different constraints. So it could be maybe like the example we had where you award more points for a rim finish than a mid-range. Maybe you play with a 7-second shot clock, maybe you say that the triggers you can use are focused on pick and roll and off ball screens, or you can't use triggers and you just have to beat your guy one on one to create an advantage. So think about like loads of creative things you can do. And honestly, like if you spent one summer doing things like that, you would be a monster. And I'm linking this too to street ball in New York and other places in America. And for me, one of the biggest problems nowadays and one of the huge limitations for young players is the lack of free play and opportunities like this that I just described, because it's all structured. And to me, that's, if you're going to a basketball practice and you're doing loads of small sided games, great, you don't need it. But if you're not getting that, I think, you know, it's really restricting your potential as a player.
Oh, that's some great ideas. I really liked it. But Leonard, before absolutely. We let him go, I have one thing I really would like to. I think I would be mad at myself if I did not mention it. So, by listening to all this, what you just have talked about, now I'm really looking forward to your answer, because let's say in the pro world, we do this a lot, and I don't really know if we are actually should do it that often. But I'll just mention a topic here, and then during the recording, I was just writing a few things down. The topic of shooting machines. So let me first just say what I've written down. Shooting machines. They're repetitive. There are absolutely no affordances. Yeah, you have a ton of time to shoot. The passes are always from below the basket. So I don't know how often do you get a pass from below the basket in the game. And there is absolutely no variability. But what is your take on shooting machines?
You summed it up, Dom. It's that they're not representative, you know. So for all the reasons you just described, they actually limit variability because of, you know, players receiving the pass in the same way, shooting from the same angle. So it's actually better to get less reps, but to get repetition without repetition, as opposed to getting more reps, but getting repetition after repetition. And that's the key difference. And, you know, if you have a coach and you have a player, I see a huge value, and I do this in Paris, when I go to Paris and here at College Prep, with just a player shooting with a coach. Great value, because you can get a lot of repetitions. But the key thing is, it's rep without rep. So as the coach, I always pass in a different way. Sometimes I might delay it and I might dribble the ball all the way to the half line and give them like a kick ahead. I might go out of bounds. Sometimes I'll be the picker. It's always random. And the shooter will always be changing location. Sometimes, well, a lot of the time I'll be playing defense on them. I'll say, you can only shoot a three. You can only play in this space. You got to play D over me. And that's how we shoot. And that's so much more beneficial than shooting machines.
Yes, I'm just so happy, because this is exactly what I started doing. You know, if I have a guy who is coming back from injury, you know, at some point I can do on-court work with him again. And exactly what you just said, that's what I have been trying lately always. I would always give him different passes, not just from the same position. I would always move myself, and sometimes I would even roll him the basketball. And, you know, typically players, first of all, look at me. I was like, what the hell are you doing here? And then I try to explain to these guys that, you know, in a game, you will rarely get this clean pass right in your hand. So it's going to be a bounce pass. It's going to be a little bit above the right shoulder, above the left shoulder whatsoever. And then I sometimes run a closeout, and I just vary these closeouts. One hand up, two hands up, two hands down. I just one fist up. Whatever it is, I try to always change it. And what do you see then, of course? Yeah, of course, they don't make as much shots.
Exactly.
But it's what you said. It's more representative, I guess.
And it's helping them become better shooters at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So,
but maybe also a reason why I think threes of an offensive rebound, usually coming a pass from under the basket, would make sense to me, why they are like at such a high percentage, because that's usually how you practice a shot with a shooting machine, or if you have like a rebounder who just passes it out regularly.
Exactly.
Last note on shooting machines. I think you can also not underestimate the level of self-confidence some guys can get by making shots. I think that's also something we cannot underestimate. But yeah.
And then it's an very interesting point, Dom, because then it, you know, it becomes a question of, is it real confidence or is it false confidence? And this is where it's really tough to know because, you know, confidence, is it an ability of a player to really do it in a representative setting? But, you know, like you say, I think, especially, you know, in Paris, like on days of the game, guys just want to shoot and I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
But I just sprinkle in the variability without them knowing. And I think that's the best compromise.
Mm-hmm. And I think maybe to add of this in this confidence thing, I think I agree with you with, I think what you said earlier about focus on the result instead of how on the technique. But one thing I want to add to this about the, let's call it, mental game behind it, because that's something I experienced a little bit myself, and I also did it with a couple of teammates of mine, and I think it's working actually pretty good. Is a, like a small drill in any shooting you could do is just after releasing the shot, like before you know if it's going in or not, challenge yourself to say miss or make. And don't focus on if you actually make it or not. Focus on if your feeling was right in the miss or make. So like not count how many makes do I have. So instead, just count how often was I right and my feeling is becoming right. And then you focus more on the feeling, on the technique, on how it feels to shoot the basketball when it's going in instead of like the result of it's just like going through the hoop.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the inherent nature of basketball. You know, you're going to shoot a lot and you're going to miss a lot, yes, too. And I think the interesting thing too is like with the CLA approach, like it applies to anything. So like take your field, like mental performance. Imagine how interesting that would be if you have an organization where not only is it Dom as an athletic coach, me as a basketball coach, but then you as the mental performance coach, all using the CLA. And that's where you avoid thinking in silos, which we see in basically every professional sports team and all these things. And then everything becomes completely interconnected. And that's, you know, that's exciting to think about.
Let's leave the discussion at this very, very nice picture of the future. I think we all agree that would be awesome. And we have one last question for you. In this podcast, we always have a guest. Maybe you have a nomination for us. So an idea of somebody that would be interesting that has some brain pops for us in this podcast.
Absolutely. So I would definitely recommend, I know he's very busy, but my boss at Paris, Will Weaver, because I think he's got some very interesting ideas. And then I'd always say just people from the ecological dynamics kind of research world, or just, you know, practitioners work in that space are always interesting. Guys like Stuart Armstrong, who runs the talent equation, Rob Gray. And then finally, just someone like Chris Oliver, who I work with at Basketball Immersion, the founder. Like amazing ideas. And I think combining like the research with practical examples is always really useful, I find.
Nice. We'll get at you for some contacts, hopefully.
Great.
And that leaves me to say thank you so much for coming here. Thank you for so many
absolutely.
Brain pops. I think this was really enlightening for me, for Dom, maybe also for you, and especially for our listeners, hopefully.
Thank you, Alex.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks so much. Really enjoyed it.
All right. And here we are in our after show where Dom and me talk about the take home messages, aka brain pops, we had during the episode or after listening to it again. Dom, how did it feel for you listening to this episode with Alex? What stuck with your mind?
First of all, I liked it a lot. I was really able to follow him very good. I mean, the way he, you know, it was just very fluent, I thought. There are so many things. I don't even know. I think I just have to pick one or two things. I mean, I was always interested in the shooting part, you know, that like shooting on one spot and for 10 makes without anything. This may be not the best idea if you have listened carefully. I mean, yes, maybe for for confidence. There is maybe, you know, maybe something plays into that. But
yeah, but again, that question, is that real confidence or is it just fake confidence?
Exactly. And that's something I like, if I have a player like who is in a rehab process and who is allowed to go back on the court, that's something that I apply now a lot. And I also tell the player, there's no sense that I always give you the same pass. No, these players will receive different passes. I'm going to close out. I'm going to pass a ball from different spots. I'm going to pass it with my left, with my right hand. I'm going to make a close out in different, you know, one hand up, two hand up, one hand or two hands to the sides and stuff like that.
Sprinkle in the variability. Exactly. I really like that.
I pass Sprinkle him a ball to his right foot, you know, so that's more game-like. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think to me, when I listen to this episode again, and especially when we talked in depth about basketball and how to coach, I was like, I had this big wish in me that I wanted to be coached this way back in the day when I was young, when I was developing. Because it's so much fun and it makes so much sense to me that you learn a lot more with this approach than with, okay, 1-on-0 layup and this is how the technique is done. And stuff like that, and just small-sided games. I was like, I have a big regret of not being coached like this back in the day. Even though I had some influences like this, I also found some stuff what I actually experienced in coaching, definitely, and I was glad about that. And I'm not trying to hack my old coaches, but you know, like this is very new. Like I said in the beginning, he's riding ahead of the wave, I think. And if this is spreading widely, I think that would be great. That would be awesome.
Yeah, and the other thing that I also liked a lot is just the fact with skill training. Yeah, when he was referring to the perception-action coupling. So usually you perceive first, then you make a decision, and then you execute. Yeah, and then you maybe get feedback. But if you're on a 1-on-0 session and you just practice your skills, you don't really, you get rid of the perception and the decision making and you jump right away to the execution of the task. And I think we're missing the first two parts. And that's what he also said in the in the episode. And that's why it's, you know, it's actually pretty easy. Just add a defender. Then everything is different. And then everything is a little bit more game-like.
And one brain pop for me that I had, I was listening to the episode last night and then I went to bed and one thing popped up in my mind. Coaches are overrated. And I was hearing the, you know, the chants of the crowd in the back, overrated. You know, I know this is exaggerated, but to me, that's the huge thing. The ego of the coaches, I know a lot. I know how it's done. I know all the X and O's. No, take a step back and let the players figure it out. And, you know, like I've been talking about it in this podcast for years already now. Coach Aito, he was the best example for me in professional sports that it's actually also working there. You know, he was never in the front, but he in the back he had all, you know, he controlled everything without controlling. You know, he had an influence on everything without actually doing it. So that to me is the perfect example still, and you don't need all the scientific data and stuff behind it, as long as you just have common sense, common human sense. That's what it boils down to me, and have trust in the players and let them figure it out, self-organization. And it's awesome. If we can spread this message with this podcast in general, that would make a huge difference, especially for youth players, but also in pro sports.
And that's exactly, I mean, I have the quote from him here. That's exactly what you just said. Instead of being instructors, we as coaches are rather architects of very rich kind of learning environments, which contain of affordances. That's just in a nutshell what you just said.
Yeah, and if we can get there in the basketball scene or in sports in general, I think the fun will come back and sports will become more raw again and more enjoyable for the players, for the viewers, for everybody included.
Yeah. Yeah, I really liked it. Very rich.
Me too.
A very rich episode with a lot of, yeah, lot of content.
We have to get some of his nominations on this podcast too. We really have to stick to that. Yeah.
All right,
Dom. Thanks for your attention.
Let's wrap it up.
Thanks for listening, guys. And let us know what your brain pops were in this episode. And let's stay in touch.
Looking forward to the next episode.
Me too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.